This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. Annie here and Tobiah.
Good morning, how are you?
Good. And it's really turning into an almost deliciously spring weather because it's now 11 degrees on Saturday morning rather than the bitingly cold 2 degrees that we had earlier in the week. So everything's on the up, Tobiah. Everything's on the up. How are you going this week?
I kind of wish it was still cold, to be honest. It would more match my inner monologue, as it were.
Yeah, things are a little bit bleak, I'll have to say. We've got news, of course, about what's going on in Palestine and reminding people that it's a National Day of Action tomorrow. There's going to be people gathering outside Trades Hall here in Melbourne at 11 a.m. and also down at the CFMEU offices at 11 a.m. leading to the 12 p.m. march outside. Gathering outside the State Library, which has been ongoing since the beginning of this disaster that's been going on with the Israeli assault on Palestine.
Yeah, and the fact that it was finally declared, while everyone already knew, that in Gaza it's a famine that is being experienced right now. We had reports come in late last night from the UN bodies. And in ABC even found a little bit of heart or something, or maybe they're scared of the Nuremberg trials or something happening to them. But they were conducting an interview with people in Gaza and with medics for UNICEF that were treating pregnant mothers that could not breastfeed anymore because they had no way of producing milk because they just can't eat anything. So incredibly important that everyone comes tomorrow or goes. I mean, I've heard even in Violet Town there will be a protest organised. So get out there.
Yeah, that's right. In my old stomping ground where I was brought up in Warrnambool, there's going to be a rally. Yeah, it's reaching into the rural and regional areas where people of conscience are making sure that they are standing up and saying that it's important, this is important. There was a strange and interesting thing happening within the Labor government of Federally. The Australian Palestine Advocacy Network welcomes the federal government's decision to cancel the visa of the Israeli member of Knesset, Shmishka Rothman. Rothman, a senior figure in Israel's far-right religious Zionist party, has openly dehumanised and normalised harm towards Palestinian children, advocated for the mass displacement of Palestinians from their homeland, and promoted the illegal annexation of occupied Palestinian land. His presence in Australia would have further legitimised the rising scourge of hate speech and attacks against Palestinians. He was going to be doing what was billed as a solidarity tour to show support for Australia's Jewish community, which of course is conflating Zionism with Judaism, which is also a misstep, I'll have to say, as many of the people who have voiced their dissatisfaction with the Israeli government's Zionist approach.
Yeah, and I mean, this comes off the back of the special envoy for anti-Semitism, who's an out-and-out Zionist, sat on a board for most of her life, Gillian Siegel. She released her report this week with, I'll just read you a few of the recommendations. This is all predicated on the fact of the IHRA definition, which conflates Judaism with Zionism. And so it's anti-Semitic to criticize the state of Israel. A few, I'd encourage you to read the whole report, but a few of the recommendations that stood out to me were that she is advising the government that we screen visa applicants for anti-Semitic views or affiliations and consistent with a risk-based approach. So if you posted anything about...
Because we're a Zionist state. Our focus. I mean, it's not that these people aren't bad actors, foreign bad actors in the Australian context.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's you have to balance these contexts in your head because you have recognition of Palestine or of this diplomatic row with Benjamin Netanyahu and Anthony Albanese and whatever, but really they're supporting. they put Gillian Siegel in place, so...
Yeah, exactly right. It leads into this thing that's been happening as we're talking about it's reaching regional areas, this whole discussion. You may have realised that there's been a big stoush going on around the Bendigo Writers Festival. A variety of different, I think it was up to 30 writers have now withdrawn from being part of that festival. And I've just found a rather interesting joint statement by the NTU and the MEAA. The NTU is the National Tertiary Education Union and the MEAA is the union that represents media workers. The National Tertiary Education Union and Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance have warned of serious risks to freedom of expression stemming from a code of conduct adopted by the Bendigo Writers Festival. The festival issued a code of conduct to participants in La Trobe University-sponsored events, directing them to, inverted commas, avoid language or topics that could be considered inflammatory, divisive or disrespectful. It also mandated adherence to La Trobe's anti-racism plan, which adopts the university's Australia definition of anti-Semitism. More than 50 writers, I stand corrected, academics and hosts, including NTU and MEAA members, withdrew from the festival over the code. Dr. Alice Barnes said it's especially galling that the La Trobe University management has used its role as a sponsor of the festival to stifle academic freedom and freedom of expression, the very principle universities are built on.
Yeah, well, this is Gillian Siegel in her report. She's got the envoy will develop and launch a university report card assessing each university's implementation of effective practices and standards to combat anti-Semitism. Along with support of the government, the envoy will embed Holocaust and anti-Semitism education in schools across Australia. The envoy will monitor media organisations to encourage fair and responsible reporting, and also it includes, among others, a recommendations to remove deductible gift recipient status from any charitable institution which promotes or engages in conduct that promotes anti-Semitism.
Oh, it's just outrageous, isn't it? Very interesting, too, that... The Anti-Discrimination Board of New South Wales has accepted a formal complaint of racial and religious vilification against the Australian Jewish Association Incorporated and its affiliated registered charity, Australian Jewish Association, TESDACA Incorporated, and they're calling for the removal of charity status for those two organisations. So there you go. It's moving on abreast. In parallel universes, the fight is on.
It's terrifying stuff to realise that there are Zionist lobby groups that have organized a summit to get all the mayors around Australia together and talk to them about anti-Semitism and the conflation of these things. And that's why we see...
Scare the shit out of them, basically.
Yeah, and that's why we see this, the fight, you know, when people do say, oh, what's it matter to us, well, or here, or whatever, in their ignorant surges, this is why it matters.
Yeah, this is why it matters. Because it's actually something that was interesting, because a lot of this stuff for businesses and councils and people like that, it's not about doing right, I'll have to say. It's actually about not being sued. That's what they're on about, because they run as businesses. Let's move to the Australian Friends of Australian Rock Art, because we're talking about the... confirmation of the Western Australian government's interference in the key Murujunga research report ahead of the Northwest Shelf illegal challenge this week. Friends of the Australian Rock Art have reacted to revelation that the WA state government wrote the contentious executive summary of the highly controversial 2025 Murujunga Rock Art Monitoring Program report, not the Curtin University scientists who were contracted to produce a report that formed a crucial plank of the approval for Woodside's Northwest Shelf extension. The stunning admission was contained in an email from the lead scientist on the Woodside-funded MRAMP report, Benjamin Mullins, in which he stated that the WA Department of Water and Environment Regulation put a very rosy spin on the results in the executive summary of the full report, stating they hoped everyone would only read the summary and not the full report. And, of course, legal action is afoot. And on a more general note, the concept of corrupt behaviour, I mean, I'm not calling anybody corrupt, I'm just saying the concept of corrupt behaviour within government was given a very interesting spin. And I was telling you, Tobias, that during lockdown, I spent a considerable amount of time actually watching the ICAC investigations into the Berejiklian government in New South Wales. I know that sounds like a very sad thing to be doing in lockdown, but I actually was watching in real time how this organisation investigated apparent government because
conflicts of interest,
and of course you might remember
the media coverages of it, you know, the why are we standing against this blooming and
this perfect little school prefect a premier who is so wonderful, and she's a woman and she's wonderful, and then she gets she loses her position and goes off and works for Telecom, but anyway, whatever, Telstra or whatever it's called, but her former squeeze, former Liberal MP Daryl Maguire, it's been said, has been handed a 10-month jail sentence for giving misleading evidence to the New South Wales Corruption Watchdog, but has been granted bail pending an appeal. Maguire was a witness at the Independent Commission Against Corruption in 2018 during an inquiry that focused on the former Canterbury City Council. It just goes on and on. It was a very long-winded affair, but the idea that he would actually go to jail.
Yeah, they had phone calls tapped with his voice. I just think it's ridiculous.
The idea that finally one of these people get a glove mark on their chin is just too good.
Well, Pam the Bird, the graffiti artist, how many years did he get threatened with, and all he's doing is putting paint on a building?
Yeah, it's quite bizarre, isn't it? Anyway, you're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Tobias, and we're reminding you that it's important to go to the rally tomorrow. The war on Palestine has not stopped. Palestinians need self-determination. Gaza must be free of Israeli occupation forces, have unconditional access to aid and reconstruction. 17 years of Israeli siege must end.
The West Bank needs the violence and attacks by the Israeli army and settlers to stop, and an end to the occupation and apartheid.
Your support to end the war on Gaza to bring peace, justice and freedom to all of Palestine is needed more than ever.
Join the nationwide rally on Sunday, the 24th of August, 12 noon, outside the State Library Victoria on Swanson Street.
With Netanyahu and Trump threatening to ethnically cleanse Gaza and annex the West Bank, we all need to stand up and say no.
Nationwide rally, Sunday, 24th of August, midday at the State Library.
With your support, Palestine will be free, from the river to the sea.
Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
This past week has been, I think, one of the hardest for Palestinians. Sorry, bear with me. On Monday, we lost beacons of truth-telling, most especially Palestinians in the diaspora and Palestine collectively felt their hearts ripped out of their chests. Palestinian mothers, including my own, collectively grieved, collectively grasped their hearts and said, Ya weli, ya albi, for their sons Anas al-Sharif, Muhammad Qreqa, Muhammad Nofal, Ibrahim Zahir, and Mu'min Alewa. We warned you about this. Time and time again, we warn you because we know the evil that is our oppressor. Yet somehow, some of you refuse to listen. We were once again let down by the collective apathy that is this current world order of imperialist fascist thugs, including those within media organizations who once again abandoned their principles of journalism and once again were mouthpieces for the Zionist entity that is Israel. When news agencies like the AP, like Reuters, like the ABC, like the SMH, say, Israel says, that is never about objectivity. Fundamentally, that is about them being the spokespersons and mouthpieces for the Israeli government. And in turn, that makes them just as complicit. So to the media organizations out there, all I will say is remember the Nuremberg trials. Remember the Nuremberg trials? Anas al-Sharif was a journalist who knew with certainty that Israel would kill him. Yet he worked tirelessly, day and night. And despite this, Anas worked towards reporting on a permanent ceasefire and an end to the bloodshed, as if he would one day perhaps see this day come. But he also prepared for the reality that he might not. And even though our beacon of light and truth was taken away from us so violently, his truth-telling still remains with us. He prepared his social media channels to carry on without him, to have teams entrusted to carry on the message of truth-telling, and to be sure that the atrocities in Gaza do not fall on deaf ears. Today, I think I'm going to be a vessel for a lot of Palestinian voices in Palestine because I think that is my main obligation as a Palestinian on stolen lands here. I want to quote Bissan Okasha, who is a 22-year-old Palestinian woman. She's 22 years old today, but she's also the founder of Seeds of Resilience, a little community-based group that is planting food in Jabalia camp, or what's left of Jabalia camp. If you know the historic significance of Jabalia camp, you know that it is the breadrock of the resistance movement. It is the breadrock of Palestinian resistance. It is where the Intifada started. It is where the Intifada will continue. And it is where the Intifada will see our liberation. Bissan wrote these words when Hossam Shabbat was assassinated. She says, when a journalist is killed, it is not just an individual who is murdered, but the truth itself is assassinated, and a crime is committed that does not expire with time. Another door to justice is shut. In Palestine, journalism is not just a profession, but a frontline battle to convey the truth. A journalist is not merely a news reporter, but a witness to the crime, and at times, its victim. The Palestinian journalist does not just tell the story. He is part of it. He chases the truth amidst the rubble, immortalizes it in the memory of the world, and pays with his life for it. This is what Palestinian journalists are about. They may have taken Anas, they may have taken Hussam, they may have taken Ismail, they may have taken Fatima, they may have taken Muhammad, they may have taken many more. Over 232 Palestinian journalists have been assassinated and murdered over these past year and 8 months. And every time our hearts shudder because they are our truth tellers, they are our beacons. And we will continue to expand their voices, and we will continue to be their vessels to carry their voices, no matter what. They will not silence us, no matter what. They will not take our voices away, no matter what. Our truth will be conveyed. But if Monday wasn't even heart-shattering enough, we had Albanese announce the intent of so-called Australia to recognise a Palestinian state. Some people celebrated this, including some people in the crowd, and I ask you to really think about this and really readjust your thinking around this narrative. This is a state delineated by Western imperialist powers, without the thought or consideration of the very people that said state impacts, the Palestinians. I, as a Palestinian, and I can guarantee you every Palestinian here, rejects this notion of state recognition. We reject your crumbs. We reject your conditions. We reject your banter stands painted in diplomatic falsehoods of statehood. We reject a two-state solution. We demand the rightful return of our diaspora people. We demand the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. No ifs, buts, or maybes. We are a people that will return to our lands as one state that is democratic and filled with dignity for all. And if you don't understand that, and if you can't hear the Palestinian call for their liberation, for their sanctity, for their livelihood, then you do not stand by Palestinians. So the message is clear. It's one state, Palestine, from the river to the sea. And until liberation and return, we reject every single goddamn spoken word coming out of Albanese. We reject every single goddamn words rejected from Wong. We reject all the apathy. We reject the media coverage of our people being slaughtered. We are our voices, and hear us loudly. We will not be cowed. We will not be silenced. We will continue to show up, and we will continue to demand our rightful return, the sanctioning of Israel, the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador, and the embargo of two-way arms trade with Israel. That is it. Nothing more, nothing less. The fact that you have to call Netanyahu to discuss a possible solution means that you are siding with the oppressor, and we reject that.
The war on Palestine has not stopped. Palestinians need self-determination. Gaza must be free of Israeli occupation forces, have unconditional access to aid and reconstruction. 17 years of Israeli siege must end.
The West Bank needs the violence and attacks by the Israeli army and settlers to stop, and an end to the occupation and apartheid.
Your support to end the war on Gaza to bring peace, justice and freedom to all of Palestine is needed more than ever.
Join the nationwide rally on Sunday, the 24th of August, 12 noon, outside the State Library, Victoria, on Swanson Street.
With Netanyahu and Trump threatening to ethnically cleanse Gaza and annex the West Bank, we all need to stand up and say no.
Nationwide rally, Sunday, 24th of August, midday at the State Library.
With your support, Palestine will be free, from the river to the sea.
Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Community Radio, giving voice to the community since 1976.
And you're back with Annie and Tobias, and we've got Isaac in the studio as well.
Were just listening to Abe Danovitz, that was Respira Palestina, and before that we heard Noor Salman from the rally, from Free Palestine Coalition, Naam from the rally they had on the weekend before.
Yeah, that's pretty distressing stuff, I'll have to say. Isaac Windsor, you're coming to talk to us about the upcoming Fuse Festival in Darebin, but we were just having a yarn there about your background. Tell us where you're from and your people.
Yeah, so I'm Yarrabal, so from northern, sort of sandwiched between the coast and inland New South Wales, so we're next door neighbours to Gamilaroi people, famously.
Fighting Gurumul people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm from up there, and my family moved around quite a bit when I was a kid, and I ended up in Victoria, and then came into Naam to study back in 2019, but obviously always still had strong connections to my country, and Yeah, my brother works in Ngarrabul language revival up on country. So, yeah, still really strongly connected to that for him and connected to country and language and everything like that, despite not living on country at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, part of the reason for why you're here is because we're focusing on the Fuse film section of the City of Darebin's Fuse Spring 2025 Festival. Now, this goes on from August the 31st to September the 14th, and it's a celebration that includes musical performance, exhibitions, and also a series of films. And you're a filmmaker. You did your study over in Footscray. People might be surprised to find that there was a film studio over there that was teaching people skills.
Yeah, it was a really independent sort of boutique community run film school. And it was, I sort of chose to go there, I think, just because of like how hands-on it was, and they really gave opportunities and they really gave really great hands-on training to people who are working there, and to be able to study art, you know, some film degrees are very like arts focused and you barely see a camera the whole time you're there. So I got really great hands-on experience when I was there and great teachers. It was quite a small film school. I think it ended up shutting down a couple of years ago, but I've still got it was a great small community environment where you could stay like after class and hang out with your teachers. We even went down to some of the bars down in Footscray sometimes afterwards as well. If it was like a Thursday or Friday. I still have pretty good, great friendships with there. Some of the people who I went to film school with there worked on this film, which will be showing at Fuse as well. And still have some great mentors from there as well, yeah.
Okay, so tell us about the film, and because it says here that you're using film to actually amplify the message of your cultural background.
Yeah. So I think with this particular, I work on like a lot of different projects. Like one thing is I work as a freelance editor as well, and most of my work with that has been focused on impact documentaries, specifically about culture and language and stuff. Over the last few years, I've worked with Indigenous Literacy Foundation, who are a really great organization, and I've worked with Australian Design Centre, and I've actually had something in Fed Square. It's currently playing in Fed Square, so Wurrung, Dumbung and Jinyu. So I've had all these really good opportunities and outlets culturally for my work as well, and then to sort of amplify that when, you know, some of my goal of making films as well with what I write and direct and that is sort of weaving those narratives into, I guess, modern cultural situations as well in like modern society. Because I think there can be a little bit of a thing where we like really separate Indigenous cultural stuff into sort of like its own bucket as well. But like in, and especially for like mob who live in the city these days, and like a big part of our lives is dealing with modern issues and the way sort of society runs and that. And so bringing those perspectives and experience that I've had with those things as well as my own personal family and cultural experiences as well, and sort of seeing how I can weave that into these more complex narratives as well of what's going on today in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, right. That's really interesting. It's a short film, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tell us about it. What's it called?
So the film's called Upper Hand, and it deals with childhood trauma, mental health. It's about a teenage boy and his single mum, and he's sort of struggling with the school system, with the public school system. And he,
surprise.
Yeah. So there's sort of no space for him, and he sort of, it's a bit of a slice of life over what's going on in, you get a good background of who him and his mom are and stuff throughout the film. But, it's sort of a slice of life of just this one period where he's, sort of being given a last chance by this one very sort of, I guess, authoritarian, disciplinarian type of teacher who doesn't, like, his take on the behaviour that the teenager Levi is going through is very much at, like, you know, the classic, the, I think the classic sort of, like, he's a bad kid, you know, he's doing wrong things and stuff. And there's obviously his mum who's, like, strongly advocating for him. But his mum, and I think this reflects on just how little education, and I think for me as a teenager and when I was younger and, like, you know, like, it wasn't even until I was, like, 18 or 19 when I was, like, reflecting on things that I had experienced, like, as a teenager and stuff. And I was like, oh, you know, like, there really is, like, unhealed trauma and stuff there that I have to work through and things like that. And so there's just sort of a lack of education. And I think with a lot of mob as well, there's just so many different layers of intergenerational trauma and cultural trauma and trauma in, like, how we're seeing society and that type of thing. And, you know, even, like, just watching things that happen to, like, our mob all the time, there's a lot of, like, sort of trauma there as well. And I think so
And that you can actually have an effect. I mean, it's odd when you're an adolescent. You, I don't know about you, but it's sort of like you don't feel like you actually have an effect.
Yeah.
On anything.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're sort of blowing in the wind. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, once you work through those things, you can sort of like help other people dealing with those things as well. And yeah,
I mean, film is a really interesting tool, isn't it? I mean, in the various interviews I've done over time making about filmmakers and filmmakers, especially when it's to do with Indigenous First Nations stories, First Nations people are really forward in, you know, if they go forward and get allies to come and work on their stuff because they know how important. It's almost like song, storytelling and dancing and non-literary forms like filmmaking are perfect for Indigenous storytelling. Mm. Is that a truth?
Yeah, that definitely. Yeah, yeah. That's been my experience as well. And like I said, with the documentary work I've done as well is like I've seen, and that's something I hope to be achieving with my work in the future of what I work towards is I've really seen this sort of space where with things like language and speaking language and culture and stuff like that.
Movement.
Yeah, exactly. Where film can sort of show that where it's not in this sort of like rigid explanation. I think just watching something. And I think a lot of things with Indigenous culture as well is just watching, like a big part of culture is to just be still and watch and to learn from that. And I think like, you know, like my film, like my filmmaking as well. And I've built this into my style. Like, I think it might be because of like my experience as an Indigenous person being that being still and watching is one of the most effective ways to really see what's happening sometimes with things and what's going on. That I've sort of, with my filmmaking, it's like, I love to just use a lot of like really long shots without cutting. And keep things like really still and just like really look at that. So I've got a lot of that in this film and in other works that I do, but it's, yeah, it's a great little space, I think, to be able to show, yeah, culture that I think could be great to expand into in the future as well.
Yeah. And how much of this like film did you feel addressing, your own like trauma that was like almost as like you were doing it simultaneously with the character maybe?
Yeah, it was sort of confronting. Well, I originally wrote the script not even realizing what it was truly about. Like, I was sort of processing stuff and I was writing this character and this and the mum and sort of the system and sort of I was like just had this idea of this story in my head based on my own experiences and things that I had seen when I was a teenager of, you know, like people in the system and like how that can affect different relationships and things. And as I was writing the script, then I started to be like, oh, you know, like I feel like I've started to I'm actually understanding what this character is going through a bit more than I originally thought. And so I was like, I'm going to use that opportunity to work a little bit more of these things in there. And I had this opportunity where I originally had this really short scene where he gets sent off I don't know if I should spoil the film or not. he gets given a last chance because of the advocacy of his mum, and she fights really hard and for him, and so he gets sent off to be with this like mentor who's like a soccer coach to do these soccer sessions, and I expanded that into this really long scene, and I got me and the awesome casting director, I'll give her a shout out, Sasha Lanyon, because she was like, I came to her with no funding for this, nothing, just the script, and she was like so supportive the whole way through, and she was like, you know what, if you end up not being able to like pay your cinematographer and you just have to shoot this on your own camera and stuff, I'm still going to be part of this project and that type of thing. So,
oh, that's awesome to have that sort of support.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I got to say as well, like that whole cast and that whole crew that I worked with and the cast too was just so, like at the rehearsals we sat down and I was like, all right, I'm going to tell you guys just up front like what my trauma actually is and tell you my story. And that was like on the first rehearsal that we did, and like strangely a lot of people were related to this story in a lot of different ways through their own experiences, not necessarily with having trauma or not. But with Sasha, we worked with Corey Saylor Brunskill, who is a very talented theater actor. He's also a rapper and musician. He's actually performing at Gumbu Gulen at the Darabin.
Yeah, this is a whole event, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So we got a lot of
crossover.
Yeah, it's interconnected. So he worked on this project, and yeah, he'll be up for the Q&A as well at the Fuse Films, and we'll be talking a little bit about that experience of working together. But he brought his really good. I don't know what the word for it is, but you know, when you improv, he brought his really great improv sort of theater style background. And I sort of just, we were out at this sunset on this soccer field, and we just went through an hour of him talking to this like young guy, being like telling him ways to manage his stress and trauma and new ways to see himself and stuff like that. And you know, I only ended up getting like a minute of that into the film.
Yeah.
You got to be so tight with festivals as well. It's like they always like want to move the story forward, and sometimes you can't fit in the things that you can't fit in the things that you find really beautiful as a director.
You're making a film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you make like a director's cut, an extended version. Even to that point that. By the time we sort of got even to sort of shooting as well, I was like working that into the script and sort of being like, I want him to speak more, because like I was processing my own emotions and seeking different outlets to process what I was feeling in different ways and to heal my own trauma and to like understand what that was and, you know, like what was required to do that as well. Yeah.
That's a pretty amazing. And also the idea that you're an editor is interesting to me too, because editing is all about time and space. You obviously attracted to that as well.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's something about the gaps between.
Yeah, the gaps between.
Yeah, there's some sort of, I don't know his name, but he was like, way back in the day, like the 70s, and he's like, it's what you don't see that's actually important. And so, yeah, with editing, like, sort of you're working in time, I guess, as well, to show, like, what is the flow, what's impactful to the story and what sort of direction that takes. Yeah, and just... You can sort of really change people's characters, like, on screen as well. Like, you know, I'm using, like, my editing background. Like, I was able to take that scene, like, that I said with Corey and that kid and make it this really just peaceful, meditative. A lot of people came back to me. The feedback strongly was, like, I love the part that Corey played. It feels just like that one really wise uncle you have, you know? And that sort of me. I actually called him Coach Brad because I have an uncle Brad from when I was a kid. And he was just this, like, he's just such a timeless sort of guy, you know, as well. Like, he seemed to have this, like, carry this timeless wisdom around with him or something.
Mm, yeah.
And so that's why I called the character Coach Brad. And I was like, oh, yeah. So that really worked with that edit there, just, like, leaving that space to breathe and to, like, allow that calm and that sense of reassurance to come in, and versus other parts where, you know, if you're editing a panic attack, you know, you've really got it. Yeah, you've got to work with different, you've got to cut it a lot tighter, but, and, you know, there's a lot more confusion there.
That gives you, like, an advantage because you're already thinking about, as a director, you're already thinking about how you're going to edit a scene while you're shooting it rather than passing it on to someone else or something.
Yeah, definitely. That's, like, a very strong part. And that's my other thing with Footscray, I think, as well, like, going back to that, was, like, it's very, like, they give you these hands-on skills so you can sort of, like, and it actually works out better as a director. You can envisage what you're doing from start to sort of finish. Whether or not you are the type of person who are more actor-focused and, you know, you don't love to get behind the camera or not, that type of thing. Like, they always encourage building those skill sets from every level so that you have a strong idea. And
what it is you're making and what you're making it with.
Exactly, yeah. The tools that you have, however limited they are, that you've really got your head around those, yeah.
That's exactly right. Tell me, we've got to finish up, but this has been a very interesting affair. So Fuse Films, 2nd and the 10th of September, Thornbury Picture House. There's going to be 6 free curated film sessions over 2 days at Thornbury Picture House. Which days are you on?
So I'm on the evening of the 2nd of September. We're doing a First Nations film evening, and we've got it's quite a big night. It's start at 6, and there'll be mingles and there'll be drinks as well. We're also screening Winningana by Jazz Money and another documentary called Lady Lash, which is another First Nations documentary. And then I have a slot where I'm screening Upper Hand, and I'm also screening
a couple of music clips.
That's it. A couple of music videos I did with Paritu. So he's a Darabin-based, like, musician. He's a Nyampa man from New South Wales as well. So we're screening a couple of those music videos, and then he'll be joining me on stage to do a Q&A at the end. And we'll also have Corey up there as well. And so we'll be chatting.
Coach Brad.
Coach Brad.
Yeah, we'll have Coach Brad up there.
You have to get him in character.
Well, we've actually still got our production designer, somehow with very little budget, came up with, I'll give her a shout out to Erin McKellen, because she did the same thing. She just wrapped her, like, third feature film as a production designer since we did that. And she just had one of her feature films just screening at MIFF now as well.
Oh, cool.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a big milestone. We came up together through Footscray Film School, so it's really exciting to see. So, but she got, like, a whole uniform for him and everything, of, like, a Coach tracksuit with his name printed on it and logos and everything like that.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I don't know how much with, like, our shoestring budget that we have. She somehow managed to put that together.
I think there's love involved.
Yeah, so I might have to get him up in that outfit again, get him up in the suede tracksuit.
Just to remind you, the City of Darabin's Fuse Spring Festival is going to be running from August the 31st to September the 14th. Go to their website. It's a big affair. There's lots of fantastic things happening, and we've just been focusing on one part of it, which is Fuse Films. And we're going to hear a little bit of Jazz Money. She was just mentioned.
So to the sunrise, with clarity and promise of who you will rise to be. So to the breaking night, who knows dance and feast and then resting. So to the moon, who sees all those standing on the edge of journey, the moth lifting to light, the glistening nectar of now, the current drifting on. So to us hands held, ready to take the first step into glory, glowing dawn. Thank you.
This is a rapacious expansion of privatisation, which is going to change the face of the city that we live in.
It's not share, it's not making the housing crisis go away. It's really about the big end of town. It's a shame job.
It's a transfer. It's a theft of public wealth, which is going to worsen the housing crisis.
The government is giving public land to private developers. Why would you do that? Why would you give all these assets over to the biggest bully in town?
We're looking down to a future that we don't know what's going to happen. Where are we going to get moved to? Dandenong? Or away from our communities and away from the services that we need.
This is a line in the sand for not only the public housing tenants, but for a Victorian society.
3CR, here to stay.
Hank is a Northcote resident. He's been a long-term resident of Darebin. He got a public high-rise public housing flat in Northcote as an older person. He's moved many times and he's constantly faced homelessness. And Hank has prepared a speech and it's great to see him come along today and talk to us. Thanks, Hank.
Thank you very much. My dear friends of public housing, it's great to see you all down here. As said, I'm a public high-rise resident who will lose my home if the demolitions go ahead. And I have no doubt that my and my fellow public housing residents' well-being are of no interest to the government. First, I know this because we were not even notified, let alone consulted, before they decided to destroy our homes. So why did the government hide like muggers in a laneway waiting to stab us in the back? If they were not cold-blooded snakes, they'd listen to people in fear of their future. The government would listen to communities in trauma as they face being torn apart. They would listen to the suffering and cries of the homeless. Do they care that their theft, smashing and destruction of our homes and security is a corrupt betrayal of human dignity and decency? If the government cared, why would they hide their documents and dirty scheme behind a thin veil of cabinet confidentiality? This is a clear sign of their deceitfulness. If the government weren't afraid of the truth, why would they would show that they properly considered the facts? The fact that buildings like ours have been retained and retrofitted successfully in many places, including Germany, Sweden, Denmark, Scotland and England. And the fact that the towers up for demolition can be fixed for less money and less environmental damage. But the government's bogus legal defence shows that they don't care less about the cost. They don't care less about providing decent housing in the middle of a housing crisis where homes now lie empty while homelessness rises. So why doesn't the government come clean? Because they want to hide the dirty truth. The dirty truth that this is clearly really about completely liquidating public housing. Shame. To feed the ruthless greed of blood-sucking private property parasites who live by stealing social wealth, destroying the roofs over our heads to build the parasites' obscene private fortunes and property portfolios. The demolitions and privatisation of public property expose the government as puppets of private property freeloaders, vultures on the bodies of their rotten, cruel system which caused the housing crisis in the first place. Tearing down the towers echoes the colonisation and exploitation of this land by theft and murder since 1788 all too clearly. Demolishing the towers will see whole areas socially cleansed of us, undesirable people, to the privileged gentrified occupiers of the land. Land stolen from our communities, transformed into sanitised high-rent havens adorned by their designer boutiques. And us, the dispossessed, the victims of this latest attack by the thieves and their puppets, will be left in the hands of new private landlords under the lie of so-called social and community housing. What a sick joke. The substitute we'll get will be badly built little boxes which cost more rent, with the ever-present threat of being kicked out onto the street like mangy dogs. The planned demolitions then serve only to make the rich richer and the poor poorer. And when it comes down to it, the use of violence of the police to evict you in the names of laws made to boost profits. The demolitions mean the eradication of public housing to the benefit of social bloodsuckers. We've only got what we have because people united and fought hard for it. If we're not to be crushed like scurrying bugs, we must unite and fight and show our real strength. Thank you.
Hi, we're from Fitzroy Primary School and you're listening to Community Radio on 3CR.
A weak solidarity brekkie team, listener, when who would have thought we'd be in total agreement with a wanted war criminal? But here we are in total agreement with Zion Supremo Benjamin Not Another Yahoo's assessment of our big Supremo Anthony Albanese as a weak politician. And for someone whose relationship with the truth is remote, for once, spot on Benjamin. Although perhaps our agreements hit a brick wall when we compare our reasons. A weak politician who betrayed Zion and abandoned Trublowasi's Jews. We assume he means those Jews who support Zion, not the many, many, many who do not. While we may think he's weak for just the opposite, 22 months of being too weak to support the slaughtered, destructed, genocided, starved, non-land, non-people. He's passed as a parliamentary friend of Palestine, obviously restricted to a fair-weather friend. Poor Anthony, after 22 months of grovelling, of supporting the slaughter, defending Zion's right to defend itself against an occupied people, its right to control and terrorise the people whose land it stole, with the imprimatur of the usual suspect lovers of liberty, freedom and democracy like Trublowasi, what thanks does he get? Told, you're as weak as piss. But what bravery? I don't take these things personally, he retorted. Well, Anthony, hate to say it, but seems to us it was very personal. And what do we know? While Trublowasi has supported genocide and resisted taking action against Zion, other than now, 22 months later, recognising a Palestinian state, ouch! Zion has not only denounced Anthony, but also revoked the visas of Trublowasi's representatives in Ramallah, in the non-land, non-peoples, non-country. Meanwhile, Zion announced more settlement expansions in the West Bank, cutting East Jerusalem off from the non-land, non-people, but no worries. This would not affect the displaced yet again for the umpteenth time non-land, non-people because, and they really said this, because they are not people. And that is the bastion of democracy and freedom, the compassion and humanity Anthony and the team have defended for 22 months. And still being defended by Lord Rupert of Wapping. His Wapping sin aghast that anti-Semitic posters were seen by dear little children in a Frankston playground. Politically charged, one targeting Zion directly. It was in shock. Perfidious material like a poster advertising a Free Palestine Danny Nong rally. My God, imagine dear little children having to see that. And worse, if it could get worse, a sanction Zion, stop sending weapons, break political ties with genocidal Zion. That would stunt a child's emotional development. And that's not all the evil in the park. That eco-socialism, not barbarism poster that's around at the moment, which would discuss the whopping sin, was in disbelief. Genocide in Gaza and, wait for it, the rise of the far right, growing militarism and the climate crisis. All aimed, obviously, at brainwashing dear little children conceived in the image of the dear baby Jesus. A mum has organised a petition, keep politics out of our children's playgrounds, claiming playgrounds are meant to be safe, joyful places. Hear, hear. Thankfully, indeed, predictably, Lord Rupert dredged up the self-styled anti-defamation commissioner, who somehow only seems to see what Lord Rupert and he regard as anti-Semitism as defamation. The title sounds official, doesn't it? But it's not. It's a Zionist construct meant to sound official. Anyway, he went straight to the problem. The swings squeak. A toddler giggles as her father chases her across the grass. More of that, and then you see it. On the slide where children line up to take turns, someone has slapped a poster, a Free Palestine poster with slogans and images vilifying Zion. It does not belong here. Parents glance at it and shepherd their kids away. Shame, poster sticker, shame. Those poor mentally assaulted parents, those poor little brainwashed children. And then a whole column denouncing those who would denounce Zion for no stronger reason than slaughter, destruction, genocide, starvation, and taking more and more land from the river to the sea. taking more and more from the creators of profit to the great exponents of the greatest little economic order of them all. The great exponents got together with Anthony and big economic guru Jim Chalmers Capital to discuss how to make the greatest little even greater. Clearly, it seems by scrapping red tape, green tape and other restrictions on gaining approval to make an even bigger killing. Good for all of us, unless we want buildings that don't fall down in the first gust of wind, or clean air and or clean water, a clean environment, and let AI run riot, which in its case is not watering down restrictions and regulations, but watering up, 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 and fossiling up, 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 but who cares? It's good for the economy, and that's what the talk fest was all about. And anyway, it's the environmental green tape that's being watered down for the common bad, and after all, the ACTU was there, which must have frightened the proverbial out of the great exponents of. Great moral exponents like K for Kill for Profit Mart, accused of utilising Uyghur slave labour. Nab Your Money Bank, Nab for inadvertently underpaying the workers it so cares about by at least 130 million and growing. Little matters like overtime, long service leave and penalty rates, very inadvertent. And of course, the airline which used to be our airline, done for sadly letting go the workers it so cares about. Worse, having to hand 50 mil to the evil union. Well, that is capitalist morality. They're just the ones who got sprung this week. Mentioned last week, the Minister for the Polluters, Murray Swatch, the environment commitment to combat the South Troubler Aussie algal bloom, when 6 months ago he was asked to do something about it. That, after concerned scientists approached his predecessor, Tania Plibersek, 2 years ago about the looming threat, and both expressed that concern by totally ignoring it. But as we said, Murray made up for the inaction by promising funds to determine which species are in danger of or have become extinct. See, he really cares. Well, to show just how much they care, Benjamin's weak politician Anthony himself headed down to see the destruction, the environmental catastrophe for himself this week, and was fending off accusations over the alleged slow response. He would have acted if it was Sydney or Melbourne beaches, locals alleged. Anthony hit back with a deeply thought-through reply, deeply developed argument. Nonsense, he said, and defended Murray doing nothing, and why Murray and Anthony wouldn't declare it a national disaster like a bushfire or flood, leaving the mind boggling at how bad it has to get. This isn't an event that Murray Swatch the environment has created or that any individual has created. This is an event as a result of a confluence of events combining to create this impact. Good point, Anthony. Strong argument. Although just maybe individuals who have created approvals for fossils and fossils and fossils may have had something to do with the disaster, which... sorry, isn't a disaster, and not sure they'd wait for a bushfire or flood to cause its damage before trying to do something about it. But no, Anthony and Murray and Tania must know what they're doing. Now, poor Murray has another problem. Having replaced Tania so he can approve Woodside with profits gas, gas, gas until 2070, guaranteeing it would not damage thousands of years of terra nullius non-land, non-people rock art, lots of environmental conditions, and now Paul Woodside with Supremo Mego Neil before profits is righteously complaining at the delay caused by those conditions. The government must act urgently to get the gas, gas, gas up and polluting. Oh, sorry, correction, up and running, up and running. Seems me has a few issues with the conditions. The conditions the government wants to impose are not technically feasible, she exploded. In what way, Meg? It is not technically feasible to protect the rock art or to protect the environment. We can't do the impossible. In fact, she added, the conditions are not based on science. In what way? Science clearly proves there is no way we can save the rock art. But imagine the damage to the transition to which Meg is so committed if it didn't go ahead. But given she finds the conditions too onerous, does anyone think for 1 second Murray, backed up by the courageous weak politician, will cave in and water them down? Of course not. But now, both Murray and Meg have a problem. This interfering Save Our Songlines mob has taken the government to court over delays, well, 3 years of delay, in ruling on the heritage value of land near the Woodside With project. The government argued a three-year delay shared between Tania and Murray was not excessive, but that Raylene Cooper, a terra nullius non-land, non-person Save Our Songlines spokesperson, reckons maybe the Woodside With approval, with those conditions of course, shouldn't have been given before the heritage value was determined. See? Selfish, selfish, selfish non-people with no concern for progress. Worse, a decision in the Save Our Songlines favour could affect industry right across the Barra Peninsula, the fossils argue. Any wonder the Environment Protection Bill Murray is working on is considering preventing people like Raylene Cooper taking legal action to prevent progress and profit, which are the same thing. Now, we also mentioned recently how Adani, the Environment's very popular Carve the Planet Michael Coal, Progress and Profit, owned by Adani the, is losing trillions, and the separate Adani rail line carrying the coal to the separate Adani the port is losing trillions all because it owes interest and all sorts of commitment to other Adani companies in low tax havens, all of which adds up to just about what they're losing. The Singapore parent just announced a $90 million profit. Not that we'd suggest there's any underhand tax dodges going on here, but this week the Queensland Caring Business Class Hayseed and Sheepshed Coal Government, Coalition Government, felt sorry for poor Adani the Planet and waived royalties for Adani while Adani expands the mine by 30%. Very courageous given it's losing all that money. See, governments do have a role. Just a pity about that algal bloom and the rock art, but what have they got to do with progress and profit? Progress and profit also facing barriers in the US of the UN of the US of the world. Barriers for pollution, resource behemoths, Rio Tinto the planet, another which has shown deep respect for indigenous culture, and our very own BHP, the big Aussie, for bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter. Their supremos meeting US of Big Supremo Donald Trump or the poor this week as they prepare to develop the US of's biggest copper project in Arizona. They obviously carry a lot more influence than the courageous weak parliamentarian, although we would have thought people would be going out of their way not to meet the Don. But be that as it may, these bloody non-land, non-people have done it again. A coalition of Native Americans, rock climbers and environmental activists have obtained an injunction against this progress and profit. Donald was livid. A radical left court, he spluttered. There seems to be an increasing number of radical left courts and judges in the US, doesn't there? It is so sad that radical left activists can do this and affect the lives of so many people, the most so many people ever, ever. Those who fought it are anti-American and representing other copper competitive countries. We can't continue to let this happen to the US arm. Wonder if it affects the lives of as many people as the Don's immigration roundups and imprisonments. A fine example of the non-radical right in the Don's world, people we all admire, his Secretary of Defence and train-killing Pete Hegseth, with his impeccable qualification as a shock jock, is holding Christian prayer services during work hours, and this week quoted his favourite pastor in Pete's church, that women's right to vote should be repealed from the Constitution. Supported by a church adherent who says she submits to her husband. If they get their way, we're narrowing it down. Non-land, non-people in Gaza, terra nullius non-land, non-people, Native American non-land, non-people, and now all women, non-people. The world's getting smaller. Pete might get a little bit of opposition from, say, roughly half the population, and hopefully most of the rest of it. Suppose white males like me are safe for a while, although Pete's church might decide people with certain political views should also be denied the vote. But finally, encouraging to know the world's biggest merchants of death, Arsenal, is in the safe hands of such intelligence as Donald and Pete. Good morning.
Good morning, Kevin. The whole idea that women shouldn't have the vote is so hysterical, I can't believe it. Anyway, you're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Tobiah, and we're coming up to the last part of the program. We've had a lot of fun this morning. We even had a live guest, which was great.
Yeah, it's awesome having more people in the studio. It makes... Yeah, it makes me wish Anila was here. We'll send out, send out our love to Anila.
That's exactly right. We always love you when you're here, and we love you when you're not. We're going to go out with a little bit of an excerpt from a book launch, which happened last week. It was for the Mechanics and the Luddite, A Ruthless Criticism of Technology and Capitalism. It's being published by the University of California Press, and it's available by order at NIBS, the new international bookshop, because on the night it was so successful that it was sold out. I was tempted to buy it, I'll have to say. And this particular launch was from NIBS and CRAM. CRAM is from Melbourne University, the people who think big thoughts from Melbourne University. And this is just a little bit of this conversation. It was with the author, Dr. Jonathan Sadowski, who's a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Information Technology at Monash University. The other person that we hear is Lizzie O'Shea. She's a human rights lawyer, writer, and founder and chair of Digital Rights Watch. The whole conversation that I put together will be part of the podcast because it's thoroughly interesting and we don't really have enough time to cover the lot. So here we go.
I think we should kick off with you reading something from it.
Yeah, absolutely. A short reading, not super long. We are constantly being made to serve the needs of two systems, technology and capitalism. Their purposes and goals are almost always prioritized above all others. Their imperatives and logics very often have more influence than any others. These systems could also be called structures. They are structures in the sense that they force social life into specific forms, but also in the sense that we live inside. We are completely entombed by these social constructs. Neither exist outside humans, but both are treated as beyond human. They are products of human values, choices, and actions, but they are also larger-than-life institutions that even the most powerful people claim to have no control over. At the same time, those powerful people deny anybody else the agency to exert control over these systems. In this way, technology and capitalism are more like religions and states. In a relatively short amount of time, just a few hundred years, really, these modern systems have altered human society and the natural world at every scale. They are not totalizing in the way that destiny is inescapable or that God is omniscient. Rather, they are totalizing in a way that is more like a toxic miasma, an oppressive cloud, emanating from everywhere, choking and trapping anything caught in its atmospheric existence, which is now essentially everything. Technology and capitalism work in tandem to create mutually reinforcing systems, which we must then work for, within, and against. We cannot understand one without seeing how it is connected to the other. They have fused together into a dual system, technological capitalism. The real complexity of these systems and our complex understandings of them as ideological and material forces is only truly revealed by seeing their parts in action and in dynamic relation with each other. This book shows that action, studies that relation, and demystifies these systems. The two opening paragraphs of the book, and I think it really sets the scene for what I'm trying to do in this book, which is demystify these systems and understand them as that, as two human-created systems that have become fetishized in a way where they seem to exist outside of humanity, but also mutually reinforced through this kind of dual power situation that also reinforces this idea that they are so complex, so massive that no puny human could possibly understand them, right? And instead, we must simply learn to live with them. And I really wanted to debunk, demystify that idea through a real materialist analysis of these systems as social constructs, as the product of people's choices, even if the people making those choices do not understand the choices that they are making. And so that I think that's where the mission of the book. In the book, I really set up what I mean by a materialist critique and by setting it against its foil of the idealist. Yeah. And because I think that is very much where our thinking, whether pessimistic or enthusiastic, whether critical or captivated, our thinking about technology is very much caught up in an idealist mode, right? And by that, I mean a mode that is kind of like we exist in our mind palace, right? That, like, you know, thoughts precede any change in the world. In fact, thoughts cause, are the prime mover of change in the world, right? Our wishes, our hopes, our desires, these are the things that create the world and create the change in the world. And we see that in all of the discourse and the claims around technology, right? That, like, you know, there's this real claims reality gap that we see. And, you know, it has been here for a long time, but I think it's most apparent right now in AI, where we think about what are the claims being made about a technology. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, only really a month ago, where Sam Altman wrote a blog post talking about how the soft singularity is already here, right? The sparks of artificial general intelligence are here. And in fact, he was claiming that internally at OpenAI, they already have AGI, right? And they're going to release that to the public with the next update, GPT-5, right? You might be shocked to learn that people who have otherwise been completely enthralled by ChatGPT are literally filing petitions against OpenAI to say, this new model sucks, and please give me the old model. Where's the AGI, right? But that's common, right? That's how we understand technology, as a series of marketing claims, as a series of promises, as a series of hopes and desires. And then we are expected to take that on as, that's how these things work. That's how they operate. That's what they do in the world, right? That, to me, is the idealism. And I think of the historian Lee Vinsel, who coined, you know, critihype, right? A kind of skeptical pessimism that is still a form of idealism. For me, though, the materialism has to stand counter to that. It has to actually say, you know, how does the system actually operate? What does it actually do in reality? And how is it the product of political economic bases and foundations that give rise to these technologies in specific ways and give rise to specific functions, right? It's, in other words, it's shining the interrogative light on the technology, maybe slapping it around a little bit and saying, who do you work for? What do you do? Right? Don't give me any bullshit. Tell me for real. Right? Like, that is the materialist method, is one of saying, I won't accept what you claim to do, I will only accept what I see you doing in reality, right? And as simple as that sounds, I think when you lay out the materialist method in this way of, like, it does sound rudimentary, but it is, I think, still a pretty radical position to take in a world where everybody is lost in their own mind palace.
And particularly where technology is seen as something that's designed by a small section of very clever men who are paid large sums of money to not create things, paid large sums of money to create things, huge amounts of money moving through this system among a small coterie of people that are supposedly smarter than everybody else, right? So that's the other way in which I think that idealist narrative is very influential in how technology unfolds. But it did occur to me reading this book that the idealist is sort of like the third character. You have the mechanic and the Luddite, and then the idealist is the two. The two are debunking the third. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about why you called it that, or what's the device that you're using when you're talking about the mechanic and the Luddite.
Mm. And you're right to pick up on that kind of third character, because that third character does come in the last chapter, where I talk about the futurist as the kind of avatar of idealism, right? But the mechanic and the Luddite as these kind of two orienting figures. To me, these are two sides of the materialist coin. These are two kind of role models for what it means to be a materialist. And I think, in short, the mechanic is an understanding of that the operations of the machine. How do you work? How are you put together? What do you do? What are the real kind of mechanical? And I really use that mechanical metaphor very intentionally because I think that there is something about digital systems.
As opposed to, say, an engineer, say.
Yeah, well, as opposed to an engineer, for sure. And I think, and I explain in the book the difference between what I see as the mechanic and the engineer, as the engineering as a profession and as a body of knowledge came out of industrial capital. Capital needing a body of mechanical knowledge that it could marshal towards ends of rationalizing labor processes, of optimizing value extraction. The engineer, and David Noble, the historian of technology, in his book America by Design, is a history of engineering. Where does this profession and this body of knowledge come from? And it is a field of knowledge created by and for capital, in the service of capital. The mechanic precedes that and exists outside of it. And I really use this idea of the mechanic very intentionally because I think there's something about digital technologies that seems so immaterial, that are so complex, right? And are kind of mystified by design. I mean, whether that's mystified in the sense of it's so complex you couldn't possibly understand the inner workings of a software system, or mystified by the technical features of like a machine learning model, which has hidden layers such that even the people creating it really have no idea how it works. They're fundamentally probabilistic, right? But the mechanic, right, I really wanted to pull in to have mechanical knowledge of, you know, the kind of the operations cause these outcomes of the system, really get into the guts of it. And to me, that's the mechanic, right, is having a sense of how the thing works. The Luddite is the kind of normative end of that coin, right? The Luddites in the original, you know, historical formulation were also mechanics, right? It is not an either or, it's a both and. The Luddites as skilled craftspeople, as artisans, as people with a lot of mechanical knowledge. But the way a mechanic becomes a Luddite is not just by understanding how the technology works, but then asking the question of who do you work for? What work do you do in my life, in my community? And also asking that question of, should you exist, right? Yeah. And I think that's that yeah. critical edge.
And what
that,
can I do to change it, you know?
Yeah, and that's that ruthless criticism in the subtitle of the book.
Or machine breaking.
Exactly, is asking, like, why do you exist and should you exist? And that's the Luddite question. You know, the subtitle of the book is riffing on Marx. You know, the ruthless criticism of everything existing, right? That is what Marx means by materialist analysis. Not taking anything for granted, holding everything up to interrogation, and not shirking from your findings, right? And I think that is what the Luddites really exemplify, is not shirking from your findings. If your findings are that this machine, these noxious machines, as they called them, are, you know, ruinous of our lives, of our communities, and so on, then the finding there is we either have to petition the boss, which they tried, please change this, or please give us a little bit of control over it. That didn't work. We have to try to negotiate with the powers that be. Well, that didn't work. We're going to protest them. Well, that didn't work. And so after exhausting every option at their available to them, they never shirked from the ruthlessly critical findings of their materialist analysis was, well, we're going to have to destroy this. We have to smash it, right? And to me, that politics of refusal is absolutely important. And I think about the really brilliant work by Anna Lauren Hoffman, who's a philosopher and ethicist of technology, who has written about, I mean, again, I think very simply that, like, no is never an option on the table when it comes to technology, right? You never actually have an ability to say, I don't consent to this, or I don't want this, or no. And if no is not an option, then you're not really given a choice, right? What other points in our life do we see as an absence of consent as a legitimate interaction, right? We have words for those kinds of interactions, and they're not nice ones. But with technology, the politics of refusal, the sweeping no off the table, is just that's table stakes, right? Instead, what we are given in replacement is an ethic of consent, or an ethic of acceptance, is what I call it in the book. What can I do to make you say okay to this technology. What can I do to make you feel like, all right, it's trustworthy enough, it's reliable enough, it's safe enough. What can I do to just make you stop complaining? That is, I think that's even the critical horizon for so many, you know, critics of technology, is the putting things on the table to say, just do this, just do this, just do that, but never putting on the table, stop doing anything. You know, I refuse.
There's some global polling which puts Australia, I think, together with Finland and New Zealand, like dead last or close to it, on most of the questions about optimism, excitement about AI. And this is often discussed in policy circles as being this huge challenge, because how do we convince people to embrace the possibility? I was like, this is a national asset. You know, we want people to be critical of these systems, because that is that's a foundation for a meaningful engagement, for a form of literacy, for all sorts of things, right? So that's my argument. Doesn't go down well everywhere, but I do make it nonetheless. I would say, like, this discussion, I really enjoy the framing. I think it is very useful for, you know, having discussions about these topics. But I would say, the book is also full of very practical examinations of aspects of the tech industry that otherwise I think come across as quite bewildering. Like, why is venture capitalist money so influential in the development of tech? How does it operate? How does it socialize its risks and privatize its gains? Also, like, how does the datafication of people operate to turn them into people they aren't, like to strip them of their humanity and their unique dignity? And what does this look like in a systemic form? What is the way in which, I liked this concept in particular, the role of landlords, understanding many companies that are, you know, traditionally called platforms or whatever, as being landlords, that is an integral part of capitalism from day dot, right? That functionality of people making money off other people's assets, right? And when you apply a materialist lens to some of the ways in which the tech industry operates, you start to see how much it's oriented away from solving real-world problems for real people and towards extracting value for a certain section of society. But maybe if I can, I'll press you, Jathan, to talk a little bit about that question of datification of people, because I love privacy. I think it's a really important...
And we're going to have to leave it there. And if you want to hear the rest of that riveting conversation, then you need to take our podcast and listen to the entire conversation that Lizzie had with Jathan.
Yeah, and buy the book at Nibs.
Yeah, support that's Nibs. Right. The Mechanics and the Luddite, A Ruthless Criticism of Technology and Capitalism. Fantastic stuff. Coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. We've had a lot of fun this morning, and we're going to go out with Vita Imaginaria.
See, your Italian's getting so much better.
Au revoir.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.